We're adding to supply. So when you restrict us, you're actually hurting the exact people these bills are intended to benefit.
Good morning, and this is Deconstruct, a podcast from The Real Deal. We're your hosts. I'm Isabella Farr.
And I'm Susanna Cavanaugh. It's March 18th, and today we're talking about single-family rentals. The institutional appetite we saw for single-family rentals throughout the pandemic looks to be a lasting trend at this point. I'll throw out Blackstone's recent move to pick up Tricon Residential, a single-family rental giant, as a strong indicator of that. But here's the rub. Legislators are looking to block institutional investors like Blackstone from owning single family rentals at all. So we'll get into that tension and whether or not it's an actual threat.
But we have quite a bit of news for you before we get into the meat today, starting with a landmark settlement. The National Association of Realtors agreed to pay $418 million over 4 years to resolve claims over broker commissions. It ends one of the largest antitrust lawsuits centered around NAR rules. For background, a group of homeowners in Missouri had sued NAR, Keller Williams, and Home Services of America, claiming they had colluded over commissions and had set standard commissions for their agents. A jury found the brokerages and NAR guilty last year and ordered them to pay $1.78 billion in damages.
So this is the next chapter. Will NAR change some of its rules with this settlement?
Yes. So listing brokers will no longer be allowed to make compensation offers on the MLS, and it will also require buyer's agents to disclose any expected commission in written agreements.
Did they admit any wrongdoing?
No wrongdoing, and NAR defended its commission sharing policies. It's also worth noting that the agreement is still subject to a judge's approval, and there's still a bunch of copycat suits that have popped up across the country since that first Sitzer-Burnett jury trial.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see how the rules affect agents going forward. So on to development. Nathan Berman, the office to residential king, is planning what would be New York's largest conversion. He's eyeing a conversion of Pfizer's former headquarters into roughly 1,500 apartments. He's under contract to buy a little less than a 50% stake in the buildings, which are on East 42nd Street.
This project really solidifies what you just said, that he's the office to resi king.
Yeah, he had another title, like King of FIDI or something along those lines. He is the king. He's also planning another 1,300 units at 25 Water Street in the financial district. So there we go again.
Mm-hmm. While we're on the topic of office to residential conversions, San Francisco voters just passed a ballot measure that would help spur office to residential conversions across the city. So there will be a tax break for any developers looking to make those conversions. You know, the city was a big proponent of it, given there's a lot of distress in the office market right now, as we spoke about last week.
Do you know if there's any affordability requirements baked into that?
No. So it's interesting. So this tax break is actually on the transfer tax. So previously, the tax rate it depends on the total sale of the price, but sellers were subject to anywhere between 0.5% and 6% on all sales. And transfers of rent-restricted affordable housing of $5 million or more may have been partially exempt from the tax previously. But under the new proposal, the first time that a property is transferred after being converted to residential use from commercial, it would be completely exempt from the transfer tax. There used to be an affordability exemption, but now it's just for all properties that would be converted into residential.
Okay, gotcha. So it sounds like those will be market rate and maybe luxury.
Yeah. All housing, I guess.
Got it.
And Susanna, do you want to talk about Daniel Obshalom?
Yes. Before I do, I have to insert a disclaimer. There are two Daniel Obshaloms. One lives in New York. The other lives in California. This one is about the California Daniel Obshalom. So the city issued an arrest warrant for Obshalom, who lives in California. However, he owns a lot in New York City. He made the Public Advocate's worst landlord watch list in 2022. So Obshalom blew multiple deadlines and extensions to correct nearly 700 violations from the Department of Housing Preservation and Development.
And residents said they've been complaining about his units for years, yes?
Yeah, it's been a really long time. He was taken to court multiple times to try and correct. The court gave him so many opportunities to. So finally, this is like a last ditch effort by HPD, the court, to try and force a landlord to make repairs in buildings. It happens very rarely, but the arrest warrant, we're not sure if he's been arrested yet. There's been no news on that. But the last time it happened to a landlord, this was a Brooklyn landlord, Aaron Stark, last year. He did just about like 8 days in Rikers, I think. And then he set aside money and hired a contractor and said, I'm going to make these repairs, and they let him out. So something similar could happen in this case.
And our last bit of news for today out of Los Angeles, CIM Group sold a 34-story luxury tower in downtown LA for $186 million, which was way less than what they were originally asking for. The firm listed the property 8 months ago for $236 million, and at the time, that price point was 40% lower than it would have cost to replace the property.
All right, so luxury residential there. Is that... just curious, is that weird for downtown LA, that sort of cut?
To be honest, we haven't seen a lot of luxury towers sell. The last one that sold was Northland's purchase of another tower in downtown LA, which also sold at a big discount than what the seller, Greenland, had actually spent building the property. But this tower that CIM just sold for about $300,000 per unit, a little bit more than that. And we're seeing, you know, suburban residential sell for more than that. So it is strange considering this is built as a luxury tower. It says something about buyers' willingness to pay at a certain price point.
Do you think it's tied to the office market in part because it's doing so poorly?
Yeah. That's what we're looking into. There are a lot of statistics out there that say that the residential market is doing really well, that occupancy is up. But, you know, if all of the office is vacant and people are only moving to downtown LA to go into the office, and now they don't have to go into the office, it's natural to think that they might move elsewhere.
Which could pressure occupancy, and then you pay less.
Exactly.
Who is the buyer?
FPA Multifamily. They're based out of San Francisco. They've been on an absolute tear on the last few months buying properties. They seem really opportunistic. Some properties they've bought from owners that have struggled with debt, and others, they bought a couple of properties in LA from an owner that was specifically looking to cash out of the city after the new transfer taxes went into effect. So they definitely seem to be picking and choosing their opportunities and not paying at extremely high price points. They also just bought an apartment complex in Chicago for $144 million, marking the most expensive apartment tower deal in the city so far this year.
So, on to our main event today. Can Wall Street hold on to the single family rental? Back in December, Democrats in Congress teamed to introduce a bill that would put a hard stop on a growing piece of the investment pie for bigger firms, single-family rentals. The bill, which is called the End Hedge Fund Control of American Homes Act, is one that real estate has characterized as a ban on institutional ownership of single-family rentals. But the fine print is a little more nuanced. The bill would require hedge funds, so corporations, real estate investment trusts, groups that manage funds pooled from investors, to unload those portfolios.
10% of whatever you own per year until they're all gone. If you don't, you are taxed at 50% of fair market value of the house, which obviously is a severe penalty designed to drive you out of the business, basically.
That's Representative Adam Smith of Washington. He introduced the bill with Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley.
So the goal here is to stop those hedge funds from owning homes, period.
However, there's some debate over how big a bite institutional investors actually took out of the single-family rental market. So to what degree they need reining in at all. And to contextualize that, we're going to roll things back to the late aughts.
What happened during the Great Recession was that there was more interest from institutional investors in buying single-family properties and renting them out, not just the multifamily space. And in particular, we also saw an entry from private equity firms who haven't really been part of the institutional investors in real estate before.
This is Jenny Schutz, a senior fellow at Brookings who researches housing and land use. So the housing crisis drove a wave of foreclosures and therein opportunities for institutions to step into the single-family rental space and buy homes on the cheap. Blackstone's Stephen Schwarzman in a March 2009 letter to investors forecast, quote, significant opportunities to acquire major property portfolios. And it did. Blackstone in 2012 acquired a Phoenix-based startup that had been scooping up distressed homes and spun out a new company, Invitation Homes, which you may recognize as the biggest single-family rental owner to date.
Turned out this was a pretty profitable space to be in, and so they stayed in it longer than people anticipated.
Profitable because during the recession, people lost their homes, they lost their jobs, and that boosted demand for rentals. But the pandemic really kicked things into overdrive. Interest rates were at record lows, rents were climbing to historic highs, and the wave of migration to Sunbelt states drew outsized interest from investors. So I'll throw some numbers at you. In 2021, buyers that owned five or more properties accounted for nearly a quarter of all single-family home purchases. Institutional investment peaked in the first quarter of 2022 at 28% of all home purchases, and that marked the highest level since 2011. To bring it back to Blackstone, BREIT in June 2021 bought Home Partners of America, which owned about 17,000 homes at the time. And it's not slowing down. In January, it said it would acquire Tricon Residential, another single-family rental titan. So here's the tension. When investors buy homes, the argument is they crowd out regular old people. And the congressman's issue with institutional control of single-family homes comes down to who those investors are pushing out.
It cuts into the ability of people to buy primarily starter homes. I mean, these hedge funds have primarily targeted homes in lower, medium-income neighborhoods. Now you have to compete against a hedge fund. And these hedge funds are coming in, all cash offers, oftentimes waiving inspections. If someone's coming in with an all cash offer, you can't compete with that. And then you can't buy a house. So you're forced to rent.
And that leads to congestion in the rental market and makes rents go up. So good for investors, bad for tenants. Plus, when tenants remain renters, they aren't getting in on one of the best ways for working class folks to build wealth, homeownership. But Jenny Schutz said the narrative around institutions boxing out would-be home buyers isn't necessarily true.
So one way I like to think about this is if there's one house on the market for sale and there are 20 people bidding on it, the winner might be a corporate landlord. But even if they didn't buy that house, you'd still have 19 people who didn't get the house. And so ultimately, this is really a problem of too many people trying to buy too few homes, not of the type of entity that's actually buying the house. It can be true on the margin. So corporate owners have a lot of cash and they have deep pockets. They may have an advantage in any given transaction in outbidding a first-time home buyer. But again, they're not the only ones doing this.
And Jenny argues that institutional investors play a minor role in rising prices.
Mostly that's because prices are going up faster than incomes and interest rates are high. So just the cost of buying into your first house is higher now than it's been in many decades. But that's primarily a result of sort of these macroeconomic forces, interest rates and housing prices. Whether corporate landlords are buying in or not is not the main driver.
Last, there's a number of different figures being thrown around as to how much of the single-family home market investors actually own. One commonly cited stat is that in June 2022, right after investment peaked, institutions owned 3% of all single-family homes. That's according to the Urban Institute. To be fair, they held a bigger piece of the pie in more affordable markets. So in Charlotte, for example, they owned about 20%. But 3%, all told, is pretty small potatoes, so it begs the question, why are policymakers getting involved?
Someone did a study that said they estimate that by 2030, hedge funds will own between 40 and 50% of single-family homes.
That's a 2022 study by MetLife Investment Management, and the figure it cited was 40%. If these bills do take effect, a group that is worried are the firms that specialize in build-to-rent, so just as it sounds, developers constructing homes specifically to rent them out. Some of those, such as Quinn Residences, are institutionally backed, and they fear the impact on their business model. Here's Quinn's CEO, Richard Ross.
My father was a home builder in the 1950s. So the home building is kind of in my DNA. In our business, which obviously we build entire communities, so your typical suburban, right, subdivision that we all think of in America, we now build those entire communities for rent.
Quinn then manages those new rentals. It owns about 5,000 homes throughout the Southeast.
So we're adding to supply. We're providing a much more affordable home than your average first-time home buyer can buy. Today, we're 46, 50% cheaper, about $1,000, $1,200 a month cheaper than owning the same home. So when you restrict us from building new communities, you're actually hurting the exact people these bills are intended to benefit, meaning those people who can't buy a home because they're priced out of the market.
So building rentals in a market that needs more homes. So would he be impacted by the End Hedge Fund Control of American Homes Act?
It doesn't affect people who build homes. If you're building a home, that's fine. I want more houses built. So we're not targeting home builders. We're talking people who come in and buy the homes after they are built.
And as for the Blackstones of the world, the act hasn't garnered the support it might need to pose a real threat yet.
It is difficult to pass legislation. We don't have a ton of bipartisan support. On the Republican side, there is a tendency to support institutional investors no matter the situation and no matter what they say. We got so many problems right now. You know, people are focused on the budget, education, healthcare, the economy, inflation. We are trying to get people's attention on this and get them to focus, but it's going to take a while.
Deconstruct airs every Monday on Apple, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Or you can listen at therealdeal.com. For comments on this episode or in the series, or if you have a guest or idea you'd like to pitch, feel free to reach me or Susanna at podcasts@therealdeal.com. Next week, we're talking to Zillow's chief economist about the state of the housing market in light of the Fed's decision this week. Tune in then.